Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this program, we discuss the many faces of money laundering, the costs to society, and the potential remedies. We're joined by two experts. Moyara Rusin is a professor at Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, California, and the director of the Financial Crime Management Specialization. She's the author of Terrorism Financing Methods, An Overview, and Dirty Laundering, Financing Latin America's Drug Trade. Richard Gordon also joins us. He's a professor at Case Western Reserve University School of Law and director of the program on financial integrity. He's the author of Public Corruption and Money Laundering, Indicators for Terrorism Financing Through Financial Institutions, and A Model Regulation on the Prevention of Money Laundering and Financing of Terrorism. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you with us.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
So perhaps we should start by definitions. We hear a lot of people talking about money laundering, but what is the actual definition? What is it? What is it not? What can we keep in the category? What do we omit? Richard Gordon, what do you say?
Well, there's a more or less an internationally accepted definition, and then, of course, the U.S. has its own, because the U.S. always likes to do its own thing. But I would say the internationally accepted definition is the hiding of either the ownership or the source of illegal funds. So in a practical sense, that usually means using a financial institution or maybe a legal person to cover up the fact that the money you got, the resources or the assets you have, are either not really yours, they belong to somebody else, or they are actually not from criminal proceeds but are from some sort of legitimate source.
Moyara Rusin, what would you add?
I think that he captured it beautifully. That is essentially the definition that is widely accepted. But I do want to add that we also use money laundering statutes to prosecute terrorism financing. So it's not simply the illegal source of the funds that we're trying to disguise or hide, but it could also be clean money that you're moving in order to commit a future crime. We sometimes call that reverse money laundering, but it still falls under the umbrella of money laundering.
So in both of these cases, are these crimes?
Yes.
Yes. Knowing or should have known. The U.S. is a bit odd in that we treat self-laundering as separate from the actual underlying crime that created the criminal proceeds. So, for example, if I go to a bank and I deposit earnings from my drug trade, I not only can be prosecuted for being a narcotics trafficker, but also for money laundering, which is a nice way of kind of doubling the potential penalty. And of course, it's much easier to negotiate a plea agreement if you double the penalty.
Yes, that is very nice. And the same thing is true for different types of threat financing, like terrorism financing. We can prosecute them for money laundering, and we can prosecute them for material support for terrorism.
So how big of an issue is money laundering today?
That's a $64,000 question. The number that is thrown around, or the statistic that is thrown around, is 2% of global GDP, which is a lot of money. But to tell you the truth, we honestly don't know. And it all depends on what you include in that definition. Because not all of the illegal proceeds from crimes around the world, including the usual suspects like drug trafficking and whatnot, but also things like corruption, you know, that is a predicate offense for money laundering as well. Not all of the proceeds from all of those crimes are actually laundered. It has to be moved through the financial system in order to be laundered. If you receive drug proceeds in the form of cash, and then you immediately turn around and use that cash to buy a meal at a restaurant, you technically are not laundering it because you didn't do anything to hide the source of those funds.
In that case, are you still dealing with a crime?
I'm going to let the lawyer address that.
Richard Gordon.
Well, in the U.S., again, we have a slightly different system where we have this thing called self-laundering. Actually, in the U.S., you could be charged with a crime of money laundering if you just have illegal proceeds and then go use that to go to a restaurant. And you actually probably could be prosecuted for money laundering there. Because what are you doing? You're taking the criminal proceeds and turning it into something that isn't criminal, which is your dinner. So you don't know the origin there. I suppose once you eat it, you don't even know if you're the person who was behind the buying of the dinner. I mean, that's probably going a bit extreme. Another thing that's goes into the question of...
In practical terms, though, you wouldn't be prosecuted for it. Right? Right, but I think that it becomes trickier if you're using large amounts of cash, of course, to buy things, and then it becomes more problematic.
Exactly, and that's sort of that's the origins of anti-money laundering programs, actually, around the world. Certainly in the U.S., was the theory that when people engage in illegal activities, such principally, actually, the sale of narcotics, of illegal narcotics, then you're paid in cash because people tend not to like to buy their drugs with credit cards or checks because it's more easily traced. So you need to do something with these big bags of cash because you start carrying them around. Maybe somebody will steal them from you. Maybe someone will, I love the old expression, drop a dime. There used to be payphones. Would call the police and say, gee, this person is carrying these big wads of cash. Perhaps he's engaged in some kind of illegal activity. So you want to get it into the formal financial system, which is deposit it in a bank. And that process, depositing this cash, would result in something called a cash transaction report in the U.S., which is a way originally of helping catch
the cash transaction report is only generated if it's more than $10,000. Or did
right,
you
exactly.
mention that?
Because
oh, okay.
you know, people, okay. if you had a cash transaction for all cash, there would be millions of reports, which would
and there still
cost
banks
millions, money. And
millions of cash transaction reports, unfortunately. But yeah.
And so when this is called the crime of structuring, which is when you have a $10,000 cash transaction report requirement, you would deposit $5,000 one day and $5,000 the next day. But the whole thing was organized around cash crimes or crimes where the proceeds are in cash. And in fact, today, I think it's well over 80% of all bank investigations of possible money laundering are structuring. So reports that then go to the government when banks see something suspicious are actually not about some sort of complicated money laundering scam. It's about banks saying, gee, I think there was structuring. But actually then what in 2017, how many crimes, or at least profitable crimes, are actually based on cash? I'm thinking probably not that many, where the criminal proceeds already is in the financial system. And I think corruption, as Mayara mentioned, is probably one of the big generators of illegal proceeds, but that is, the proceeds are frequently not in the form of cash bribes. They're in the form of kickbacks, et cetera, that are already within the financial system.
So, Richard Gordon, before we go on, Moyara mentioned the percentage of GDP that we're talking about. Do you have any numbers about how big this could possibly be or an estimate?
Well, when I was at the IMF, we tried to figure out sort of an accurate, even remote, within an order of magnitude, guess as to what the amount of money that was being money laundered each year. And effectively, we came up with a number that the then managing director of the fund just spit out during a meeting based on nothing. So he just sort of said, I'll make up a number. Oh, he said it with a French accent, but he said, I'll make it a number. So I don't think we really have. The only statistic that I've seen that has any basis in empiricism is the FBI went out and tried to estimate what is the price that is charged by professional third-party money launderers. So, if, you know, I give you $100,000, what am I going to charge you? So what they did is they sent people out pretending to be money launderers, I guess, and they figured they typically would charge 20%. So if that's true, it's pretty significant that a significant amount of money is being laundered and that to get around it, it's going to be 20%.
Can I add something
to
the 20%?
Of course you can. Moyara Roussin.
Thank you. I learned something very interesting from some folks in the intelligence community who were trying to gauge whether or not all these different policy measures and law enforcement efforts were having any impact on specifically drug trafficking in Latin America. And one of the things they looked at was the commission that the money launderers charged. And it actually increased from as little as 5 to 10% in the 1980s, up to then 15%, and then as high as 20%. And so the reason it's gotten that expensive is because we're making it more difficult for them to do that.
So let's talk about who launders and who the launderers are that are taking this 20%, and who needs them, and why. How is this done? Why is this done? Moyara, do you want to start?
Well, there are a number of different people who could fill that role of money launderer. Sometimes we refer to gatekeepers, and these would be lawyers, accountants, notaries, and other people who are in a position to not only help you structure your dirty cash, but they could also do more sophisticated things like set up offshore entities like trusts and other types of things to really be more opaque and muddy the trail for any law enforcement that might want to follow the money. And that's who we're trying to pay attention to right now, to keep a closer eye on those so-called gatekeepers. But you could have, in fact, crooked people who are actually working in a bank, and there have been cases like that, where the folks working at the bank are themselves compromised. We do try to do background investigations on every bank employee. Banks do that here in the U.S. And carefully monitor what their employees are doing to minimize that from happening. But, you know, that's another option. But what I tell my students, because the types of courses that we're teaching here at the Middlebury Institute in our financial crime management program teach students how to launder money. The only way you learn how to fight it is to learn how the criminals are doing it. And the caveat I give them is that if any of you decide to go to the dark side, keep in mind that even the best money launderers eventually get caught, because all of your clients are criminals. Who are they going to turn in when they cop a plea? I mean, we have this wonderful plea bargain system in this country. You can lighten your sentence by pointing fingers at somebody else. And that is, in fact, how a lot of money launderers go to jail, not necessarily because they make a mistake, but because one of their clients turned them in.
That sounds like what happened with Manafort and
Papadopoulos.
Yeah, Manafort and Gates.
Yeah, except Papadopoulos was not the money launderer in
right.
this case. Manafort probably had lawyers working on his behalf, setting up all of these offshore shell companies, and they were not doing a very sophisticated job of it.
Richard Gordon, you actually wrote a piece about how you hide and launder $20 million for the New York Times. And you were referring to Manafort in particular. Why don't you walk us through this?
Well, I'd like to point out that I was not suggesting this is a good way of doing it, or that I should go over to the dark side, as Moyara suggested. It's interesting because as far as we can tell, it doesn't appear that any of the anti-money laundering so-called preventive measures that we've been talking about at banks, what they're supposed to do, whether it's reporting when there's significant cash deposits or significant cash withdrawals, as in the former Speaker of the House was charged with actually structuring. He was taking money out to buy off potential witnesses in his sexual harassment case.
Right?
Yeah, exactly, with Dennis Hastert. It doesn't appear that the banks were ratting out, so to speak, the laundering of Paul Manafort. It appears that it was just some heavy-duty investigations by the special prosecutor that, as Moyara suggested, they didn't do a very good job of hiding it. So Mueller and his team were able to go out and using good old-fashioned investigative techniques, including getting somebody to rat them out, able to find that these folks were laundering money, which probably should have happened. So what they did is set up a bunch of offshore accounts. Money was deposited into those offshore accounts, and nobody reported that to the U.S. government. They did not voluntarily report that to the Internal Revenue Service. What a surprise. I'm trying to hide my ill-gotten gains, and I'm not going to declare it as taxable income. What a surprise.
Right. And I think, though, he was one of the things that worked in his advantage, and one of the reasons why it didn't go unnoticed is that the source of the funds was coming from overseas. So it sounds as though the Russian-backed political party in the Ukraine was paying Manafort directly into those overseas accounts. So it doesn't sound as though the money was coming directly to the U.S. and then going to those overseas and to
exactly.
those offshore entities.
The deposits were straight to the offshore account.
Right. But we
and
do
then,
have
then you don't declare it.
Right. We do have measures in place to detect some of what he did today. For example, the geographic targeting orders that are aimed at high-priced real estate purchases that are made with an offshore entity, which is one of the things that Manafort did.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about money laundering. So an offshore entity like, for example, Manafort had, this is from Richard Gordon's article, actually, something like 30 companies that opened bank accounts in places like Cyprus and the Grenadines. Is that what you mean?
And using those offshore entities then to purchase the real estate in New York State. Is that, I believe, well, I'm going to let Richard.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So but there would have to be a bank involved in the U.S. So you'd have to have some sort of correspondent banking relationship with a U.S. bank. So, I mean, you would send a payment from a trust account, or I guess these were actually companies that were organized in Cyprus, from a Cyprus bank to the U.S. bank. Whoever is selling the property would have to have a bank account. So if I were the U.S. bank, or if Mayara and I were compliance officers there fulfilling our anti-money laundering requirements, I would think we would look at this and say, as Mayara said, this is a higher risk receipt of a payment from it's a geographical risk because it's Cyprus, and we know that there are a lot of dodgy things going on in Cyprus. We might even ask the Cyprus bank where that money came from. If it came from a political party in Ukraine, that would be another question that would raise the likelihood that there was something dodgy going on. And then it's to buy high-priced real estate, and as Mayara said, that the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, the Treasury agency that looks after these things has said, well, high-priced real estate, that's another much higher risk type of transaction. So the bank, I would think, would, under their AML requirements, look at these. It would go to the bank's internal financial intelligence unit, which means basically just a bunch of private investigators that the bank hires in order to fulfill their requirements, and then say, this doesn't make any sense. So we'll send in something called a suspicious activity report that then goes to the government that can be used to start an investigation or to advance an investigation that's already ongoing. I would be surprised if those kinds of suspicious activity reports were not filed, at least on a number of these transactions. So,
right.
If possible,
and that's something we won't know.
No. Disclosing them is illegal. Even it could send you to jail if somebody at the financial institution or at the government disclosed that, so we don't know.
So,
I would hope it didn't seem to be that was going on. But I think one of the issues is it's very expensive for financial institutions to implement these kinds of programs to monitor client transactions and when they bring a client on board. I never liked that term, onboarding clients. It's not post, Guantanamo Bay, as I should call it, something else. But when you bring a client in and the bank is supposed to look at the client, see if it's a high-risk person in a kind of business that might be more likely to hide the generation of criminal proceeds, and then look at these transactions based on things like geographic risk, risk with respect to the type of investments that the account is used to purchase, and then do a little investigation and then file a report that actually describes why the bank thinks that something is dodgy is going on. That's very expensive. So the question is not just, is it effective in terms of, as Mayara said, the commission for laundering has gone up. And that suggests that, at least with respect to narcotics proceeds, yes, the system is effective, but it's so expensive. Are we spending $1 billion to catch $10 of money laundering? That's something we don't know, and that's something we really need to investigate.
Let's turn for a bit to both the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers. Now, these suggest that a lot of people are offshoring, hiding money, looks like tax evasion, companies, universities. What is it?
Hey, they're going to tax our endowments, so the new tax bill. So
right.
We need to hide our endowments from the tax authorities here.
So to what degree are we dealing with just tax evasion, or are we dealing with a type of corruption? Are we dealing with a type of money laundering? What exactly is being revealed on this level with Panama Papers and Paradise Papers. Moyara, what do you think?
I think there was a lot more nefarious activity going on with the Panama Papers data dump. The Paradise Papers, at least what we know so far, a lot of it appears to be legal tax avoidance. So it's not illegal per se, but it is nevertheless troubling that we do have these legal loopholes that allow companies and individuals to hide their money overseas and not pay taxes on it. Now, in some cases, it does become illegal if you don't declare those foreign so you create an offshore entity, you register an offshore entity somewhere, and offshore does not mean on a Caribbean island. Offshore could be Delaware. Offshore simply means outside of a major financial center like London or New York. So you have these offshore entities. Those offshore entities need a bank account in order to do bank transactions. And not declaring that overseas bank account is a crime in the United States. If you don't file what's called an FBAR, it's a foreign bank account reporting form with the IRS when you file your taxes. So maybe some people might get into trouble with regards to that. The other areas where people might run into trouble, we do have lists of individuals and entities that no U.S. citizen or U.S. company is supposed to do business with. So these folks are sanctioned or they're put on an SDN list. And if any one of those individuals owns by themselves or collectively, any of these individuals collectively own more than 50% of any entity, then you're not supposed to do business with them. And Wilbur Ross, for example, was doing business with Vladimir Putin's son. I don't know if his son-in-law was one of these sanctioned individuals, but there are two other Russian sanctioned individuals who were part owners of that company. Now, he may get away with that because they didn't meet the threshold of ownership. Maybe they only owned 20% of the company. But there are all of these dodgy, I mean, it looks bad. Regardless, the optics look terrible for the people who were outed by this leak.
Richard Gordon?
So I have not seen any of the, I'm not part of the journalist consortium has actually been able to look through all these, the pages and pages of release in either the Panama or Paradise Papers. But from what I've been able to glean, there has been a change over time. And many years ago, before anti-money laundering rules, particularly with respect to the criminalization internationally of proceeds of crime, hiding proceeds of crime, has such that in the old days, I could set up a bank account, say, in the British Virgin Islands. I could set up a company in my own name that would have an account in a bank in the BVI. And I could pile that account full of proceeds of my corruption, of my drug trade, or whatever. And the BVI, they did not have a law that said, gee, we can capture those proceeds of crime. You know, you will forfeit them and we might even try to get you to visit the BVI so we can put you in jail. But since then, since the adoption of international standards on criminal proceeds and anti-money laundering, I would never in a million years set up a bank account in my own name, nor would I actually set up a company and actually admit that I owned it. I would have a confederate do it. I would have my favorite friend, the viola player, which apparently is what Vladimir Putin did. I would never own anything in my own name directly or indirectly unless I'm a complete fool. So that has, I think, changed. It used to be dictators would set up companies in their own name, even bank accounts in their own name. But now they would never do that. And one of the things that was interesting in the change of the Financial Action Task Force, that's the International Anti-Money Laundering Standard Setters, set of, they call them recommendations, but they're really requirements, a number of years ago was to say, gee, financial institutions have to identify where there are politically exposed people are setting up bank accounts. Because you have Sunny Abacha, the dictator in Nigeria, who's setting up bank accounts in the U.S. and protecting those assets from investigation and seizure in Nigeria. So they said, well, from now on, banks have to identify politically exposed persons, those people who have authority or influence in their own country and who are therefore more susceptible to corruption. So as soon as that rule went into effect, and the U.S. has implemented that through through regulation, what politically exposed person, what dictator or president or even county commissioner in Ohio who is corrupt, actually admit that they owned that bank account or controlled it? They never would, because at that point, the only people who wind up having this higher level of attention by the bank, higher level of due diligence, so-called, are politically exposed persons who are honest. They admit it. Oh, yes, this is my bank account. Mm-hmm. And they tend not to be the corrupt ones, obviously, because if they were, they wouldn't admit it. And as a result, the bank says, well, since you're a politically exposed person, we have to do all this additional work. Our financial intelligence unit, our investigators have to look into you, and that's expensive. So what often happens is the honest people who are not dumping huge piles of money into these accounts because they're honest wind up, the bank closes their accounts and says it's too expensive to keep you on as a client because we have to push through all of this investigative work and report perhaps eventually you to the government. And this is called the phenomenon of de-risking, which has been in the news lately, which is often folks who are honest nonprofits who are sending money to areas of geographical risk, who are honest government employees or politicians, wind up admitting that that's who they are, that they are behind these, and they wind up losing their bank accounts because of their honesty.
When we come back, how money laundering finances terrorism. Stay tuned. Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about money laundering. Moyara Rusin is a professor at Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, California, and the director of the Financial Crime Management Specialization. Richard Gordon is a professor at Case Western Reserve University School of Law and director of the Program on Financial Integrity. Let me just switch gears for a minute. There was an opinion piece. I think this was in The Guardian. And it talked about an international oligarchy or a globally mobile republic pertaining to the very wealthy who use all of these mechanisms to avoid taxes and sometimes to launder money. Are the only people that are honest really these NGOs you're talking about, Richard, and also you and me?
Oh, God. Given what's happening in Washington right now with the, the Jobs Act and Tax Cut Bill, I forget what it's called. I don't know why anyone would need even to go to all this trouble of laundering your money to avoid taxes. You just cut them in your own. If you're a powerful enough oligarch, you'll just cut the taxes in the statute. So I don't know. What do you think, Moyara?
Right. I don't want our listeners to think that there's some kind of global conspiracy, but there is a lot of power in too few hands, most definitely. But going back to the point about PEPs that Richard mentioned, he's right that it is getting very expensive for the banks. However, they are allowed to take a risk-based approach. So, for example, they don't have to carefully scrutinize and put hours and hours into transaction monitoring for, say, politically exposed persons from Norway and Denmark where corruption levels are so low. But if they, for example, are seeing funds come from Equatorial Guinea, for instance, which is very highly corrupt, that are going to purchase multi-million-dollar properties in New York City, well, that's very suspicious, and that would be very high risk as well. And so that would be set aside for a closer look, and they would carefully monitor those accounts coming from Equatorial Guinea. But the other thing that they do is, again, hide who the beneficial owner is of these offshore entities. So they might create a company, Acme Limited or ABC Trust, as a way to disguise who is actually the owner of those funds, they can also create an entity that has what's called a nominee director, which is just some Joe Schmo they pull off the street. It doesn't have to be anyone who has anything to do with the account, because they sign over power of attorney for the account to the corrupt politician or whoever it is that's trying to hide their money. That's another way to disguise it. Well, we are now trying to introduce new laws, and in countries where those laws exist, enforce new laws on identifying the true beneficial owner. It's difficult, it's complicated, and it's going to take us a while to get it right. And I'm not sure that Putin's viola player, as Richard mentioned earlier, would necessarily be identified as a politically exposed person, but the larger banks are now able to identify somebody like him as suspicious because they have access to very expensive platforms like WorldCheck, for instance, that gives them that kind of intelligence on individuals like that.
It just seems like with the sort of global playground, if I can use a crazy phrase like that, makes it really hard to enforce any kind of law if people have the capacity to move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and any law enforcement officer is going to have to chase it down in his own jurisdiction for the most part. As I understand from your work, that there are some international regulatory bodies, but it's not going to be able to handle this much complication. Richard Gordon?
That's exactly right. And any matter that involves international cooperation in investigations or prosecutions or asset seizing and confiscation, just by definition, is going to be more difficult because you're going to have to get two jurisdictions to cooperate. And at the very the most basic level of interviewing, of taking evidence, all the way up to court cases, and the more jurisdictions you have, the more difficult that is by definition. So this is nothing new, but it's...
It does seem like there are new methods and new complications. And it also seems, and this is to something that you said earlier, with this particular administration and this particular Congress, it seems like the United States is kind of going the other way.
Going back to something else that Moira was talking about, that, for example, there are rules that allow financial institutions to operate their, actually all their activities, but certainly anti-money laundering requirements on a risk basis. But the reason that banks and other financial institutions implement their anti-money laundering requirements at all is not that they're really nice people and think it would be really fun to spend a whole lot of money trying to catch bad guys. They do spend a lot of money trying to catch bad guys that are defrauding themselves, that are defrauding the bank. They go after credit card fraud, mortgage fraud, because that's money out of their own pockets. But when the money is coming out of somebody else's pocket and they're the mere innocent third-party launderer, why would they spend money on trying to catch bad guys who aren't hurting themselves? Well, they do it because the government enforces their anti-money laundering requirements through a process of bank examinations. Every bank has to undergo a full bank examination once a year, with a few exceptions, and they examine for compliance with anti-money laundering rules. So one of the problems is the way in which the actual examiners go through the process of seeing, hey, bank, did you actually implement your requirements, is they may not, and I don't want to disrespect anybody in the supervisory area because these are very difficult things to do, but it's difficult for them to know exactly what part of the 500-plus page anti-money laundering examination manual they should focus on an exam. And in the past, one of the problems with de-risking is that the financial institutions, the compliance officers, believe, and they have good reason to believe, that when they undergo a bank exam, and the examiners are not saying, it's okay, you did it on a risk basis. They're saying, you have all of these offshore accounts. You have all of these politically exposed persons. You have all of these nonprofits, which in the exam manuals suggest that they are of higher risk. You have all these people, they're legal entities. So you better spend a whole lot of time proving to us that you're adequately enforcing the rules against these folks. It's just easier for the banks to dump them. Even though they can do it on a risk basis through the examination process, sometimes they just think we really can't. And that's been one of the big problems.
Moira?
I agree. I do agree that that is leading to a lot of de-risking, especially for money service businesses that are operating in Africa, Southeast Asia, and some parts of Latin America. It is an issue, and I worry that it is driving those entities to smaller banks or informal value transfer systems that we have no way of monitoring. And so that is another problem that could be something that we need to think about in the future. But I do want to add something else. One of the reasons why banks are putting more money and more human resources towards their anti-money laundering efforts is because of the very steep fines that the regulators in the U.S. impose on banks. And some of the international banks have been caught off guard and hit with some of the largest fines. I would say 15 years ago, the fines were in the tens of millions of dollars for some of the larger banks, and we thought that was big. And it certainly was compared to any other country that was trying to enforce money laundering laws. Then they jumped to the hundreds of millions. And then finally they hit the billions. So HSBC paid about nearly $2 billion in fines. Then Standard Charter, they've been paying almost $1 billion. And then BNP Paribas was hit with a $9 billion fine for anti-money laundering violations and sanctions violations in particular. That is what is pushing those banks that operate in the U.S. They don't have to be U.S. banks, but they just have some connection to the U.S. That is what's pushing them to put more attention into this area, and I think it's great. My concern is that other countries do not have that kind of regulatory pressure, or for that matter, fines that amount to much that a bank would really care about. It's not that, what impact are we having? It is having an impact because the U.S. dollar is still the world's most important reserve currency. And any bank anywhere in the world that wants to do business in U.S. dollars, which most of them need to do, will have to at least have an anti-money laundering program in place and be able to demonstrate that if they want to have a relationship with another bank that can help them clear dollar transactions. So, it is having an impact.
And that is, of course, if the U.S. doesn't go completely dereg like it seems to be motioning toward, right?
That is a concern.
And we have a new controller of the currency who has been at least indicating that perhaps there will be a lighter touch, and it's the controller of the currency who examines primarily for anti-money laundering breaches. But it's not just fines. There have been criminal prosecutions involved with all of the big fines that Mayara just mentioned, and which have resulted in a so-called deferred prosecution agreement, which is we tell you to fix your problems, and if you fix them under the enforcement action, then we will not go forward and try to put you in jail or pull your banking license entirely if we find that the bank itself is a criminal enterprise. What's even more scary, I think, for financial institutions is that local attorneys general, so states, we've been talking about the U.S., but of course the U.S. is composed of states, district and a few territories. All the states have their own anti-money laundering laws. I shouldn't say all of them, but I think they all do. One of the big ones, of course, is New York, and a lot of foreign banks have U.S. subsidiaries that are in New York, but most big U.S. banks have at least some presence in New York, and the attorney general of the state of New York is not under the supervision of the Justice Department. So not only can the Justice Department go off and bring a criminal prosecution, but fully independently, the state of New York can through the Attorney General's office there. And when they start looking not just at banks as institutions, as legal persons, but start looking at potentially prosecuting the individual human beings who run the compliance programs, They threaten them not, well, the bank will pay off the fine, but we might put you in jail, or even if we don't succeed there, we might ruin your reputation. And you have all these independent actors, the U.S. government as well as state attorneys general. That scares people away from doing the job in the first place. Why do I want to be a compliance officer if I might go to jail? So, or at least be prosecuted for it. And that kind of, so sometimes threats are very good. Fines can be very good in enforcing the law. But when you start threatening individuals whose jobs are to catch the bad guys and say, gee, if we don't think you're doing enough of a good job in catching the bad guys, maybe in part because your management, the board, is not giving you the resources, we're going to actually go after you. And the whole, we'll indict you for this, and we might send you to jail. And it's really wearing on people interested in going in or staying in the job of compliance officer for anti-money laundering.
Right. But in practice, the only chief compliance officers who have been charged were acting egregiously, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, definitely so far. Okay. But if you happen to have an attorney general in New York who's, I don't know, wants to run for governor and then eventually president, who knows how far they'll go? Maybe they won't, but it's... Often the type of folk who goes into compliance is someone who worked for law enforcement or was a prosecutor and got into this job because they really want to catch bad guys. And even the threat that some independent law enforcement actor might go after them, it has a chilling effect, I think, on employment in the field.
One of the things we have not yet talked about that we should turn to, because you've both looked at this, is about terrorism financing. Richard, you're the one that said it was classic money laundering techniques used to finance terrorism, right?
Well, the study I did was for the UN Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force, and it was looking at folks who were being at least investigated and prosecuted for material support or terrorism financing or just being terrorists themselves. All the cases that we looked at were from the U.S. and were not cases involving quasi-state actors like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. What was going on? Essentially, they're stealing money, they're taxing people, and they're selling oil illegally, and they're using that to pay their terrorists domestically. But looking at the folks in the U.S. who would be supporting terrorism abroad or occasionally in terrorist acts in the U.S., they were using classic money laundering techniques, even though it was not illegal proceeds being used, you know, trying to hide that to buy useful things for yourself. It was, we're guessing, I interviewed one terrorist in the process of doing this report, but in the 300-plus cases we looked at, we didn't know exactly why they were doing what they were doing, but it was very, very simple stuff to cover up there, that they actually controlled the account. And probably the reason for that was it's still hiding ownership. It's hiding sources. It's hiding who's involved. So even though the money was not criminal proceeds, it was honest money to do something dishonest. But just to add to the oddness of our rule on terrorism financing, I remember I was involved in the adoption of the international standard on recommendation, so-called, on terrorist financing. And I said, so wait a minute. We're only concerned with the financing of terrorists, and terrorism defined internationally as applying pressure, threats, or some other technique to get a government to change its policies. I said, but what about just crime in general? I mean, if I go into a bank and I say I'm taking $200 out to buy water balloons to throw at somebody who's going to give me a ticket for overstaying my meter, that's terrorism financing. But if I go in with $200 and I use it to buy a hand grenade to blow up my house and kill my family, that's not terrorism. So that's okay. So the whole idea that we're looking only at terrorism as opposed to financing criminal enterprise with honest dollars to begin with, I just don't understand that distinction, and I'm puzzled as to why we went down that path. I know why we did. It was 9/11, and we wanted to get lots of countries to sign on to it right after 9/11. But from a policy perspective, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Moira Arusin, what would you add?
I would agree. And you are starting to hear policymakers in the world's capitals start to change their rhetoric. Instead of talking about terrorism financing or terrorist threats, we are more vague than that. In fact, people talk about threat financing. So threat financing can include an actual financing case that's related to a designated terrorist organization. but it could also be a drug trafficking organization. It could be proliferation financing, you know, that laundering activities on behalf of the North Korean government for the purposes of raising money for their nuclear program. And so we're starting to see the language around all of that change. And one of the things we've always had a problem with is having an internationally recognized and universally accepted definition of terrorism. Going with the threat financing label gets around that.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about why it's so hard to track and prosecute money laundering. Moyara, I'm looking at a quote from you that was, I believe, in a Forbes article where you're trying to describe the financing of terror. And you say, let's say a terror cell in Bosnia wishes to send $100,000 to another cell in Paris. Rather than transport cash, they can import cheese.
Right.
Yes, trade-based financial crime. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Walk us through how these things work.
This is something that's been going on for a long time, and unfortunately, governments are not devoting the necessary resources to address it. It's either overpricing or underpricing imports and exports in order to surreptitiously move money across borders without actually moving any money. And if I were to give a really simple case, let's say that I want to send $90 to Richard, and I don't want anyone to know that I'm sending $90 to Richard. I might say, Richard, I want to buy a book from you for 10 bucks. It's a $10 book. I want to buy that book for you. And I want you to send me an invoice saying that that book is really $100. So Richard spent...
I have a whole bunch I can send you for that.
Yeah, there you go, right? So, you know, Richard is out of pocket 10 bucks because he has to send me the book. But I'm sending him $100. So at the end of the day, he is now $90 richer. And we did it simply by agreeing on a trade transaction. He sends me a book, and I'm paying for the book by sending him $100. So as far as law enforcement is concerned, I simply purchased a good from him. And it doesn't have to be an actual product. It could be consulting services. Let's say that Richard is providing me with, you know, $1,000 worth of consulting services, but we're going to say that it's $10,000 of consulting services. So I am transferring, on balance, $9,000 to Richard by creating false invoices.
And imagine how difficult that is to check. I mean, and this is also a technique used for laundering money.
Right.
It's been used quite a bit in Latin America, where there isn't actually, the concern is not the transfer of actual funds, but it is covering up the fact that it's the proceeds of crime, often corruption.
Mm-hmm.
So my job here in Cleveland is I award contracts to pave roads. And so what do I get? I get a kickback from the company that's the road paving. It's charge them $1 million, and in order for them to get the contract, they have to pay me $100,000. So if I wind up with $100,000 in my bank account, that was going to look suspicious because that's, you know, I'm just a low-level official here in Cleveland, so my annual salary is, say, $50,000. So what I do is you set up an intermediate company. And what the paving company pays the intervening company, which is a consultancy, and they say, well, we pay them $100,000 in exchange for consultancy services. And then I access that money over time, or the consulting company, which is just a dummy company, doesn't really exist, buys me a car, buys me a house. That's a house for $100,000. That wouldn't be bad. And so that's a way of hiding it. So it's not the transfer so much. It is the turning what is clearly criminal proceeds into something that looks honest, which is legal or consulting services. And as Moyara points out, that's a very effective way of avoiding not only attention from the authorities, but it also, once they're trying to look into it, I said, what is this? And I hand them a ream of pages that I've just downloaded from the internet. I said, well, this is my consulting service. I spent 2 hours on the phone. He's a genius attorney. I took notes. So it's very hard to prove that, in fact, that transaction did not occur, that there was actually something that was worthless as opposed to something that was worthwhile for which a payment had been made. And it's a great way to launder money, very common
right.
in from the research that we've done.
I worry, Richard, that you're giving our listeners ideas.
All right, so I have one. If I have a moment, I would give one very quick story. You probably saw the theft of money from the Bangladesh Central Bank that was then laundered through a
casino in
the Philippines.
$1 million.
Worth billions of dollars. So I was on the team that assessed compliance of the Philippines with the anti-money laundering standards, and I noted in the report that that casinos in the Philippines were exempt from all anti-money laundering requirements. And one of the reasons for that was that the president of the Philippines got a certain percentage of the turnover that was paid into a discretionary account for the president. I said, this is a huge gap in the Philippines' anti-money laundering armor, so to speak, and then turn around and I wonder if somebody read that report, because the report was published and it was publicly available, and all of a sudden, yes, they chose my preferred way of laundering money. So I guess I feel guilty.
So I wonder if in the last couple of minutes that we have, we can talk about what is the cost of all of this? I mean, clearly there's a huge cost to the public funds that would normally go to pay for our schools and our universities, and although universities are doing it too, some of them anyway, or, you know, some of the other public services, whether it's fire or police or water or trash. What can we say about the cost of all of this?
So let me just say that I don't think that the universities are engaging in tax evasion. They're merely trying to hide the true nature of some of their investments in case some of their students might be upset that they're investing in things like fossil fuels and other controversial issues.
I was just going to say, if I could add to that, there are reasons for hiding your assets that are not nefarious. For example, if you live in a jurisdiction that is, shall we say, not quite so cognizant of the rule of law, I can think of quite a few, and you might just want to hide your assets because you're afraid the government's going to steal them, or you're afraid that some gang leader is going to steal them. So it's not a bad idea to keep them parked somewhere else and to keep the fact that you own any assets secret. That's why the British Virgin Islands is one of the big places that mainland Chinese have their assets in BVI companies, and it was when Hong Kong was moving towards, Hong Kong residents have their assets, because when Hong Kong was moving towards being reunited with the mainland, BVI went over to Hong Kong and said, would you rather have British law protecting your assets or Chinese communist law protecting your assets? And they said, oh, I think we'd rather have British law. So they set up companies in the BVI, put their assets there. And then it was a British judge who was ensuring that the rule of law protected those assets.
Fun fact, it turns out that because of that, even today, when Chinese do want to set up offshore entities anywhere in the world, whether they're setting up the entity in the Seychelles or in Cyprus or Bermuda, they still call them BVIs.
I didn't know that. That's great.
I imagine there are a couple of things. One, we were talking about the cost to actual public funds, right, and things that we need as a country, as a humanity. But I imagine there's also this sort of culture of lawlessness that is getting fed. Do you have a sense of any of that?
Yes. Well, as we said, there are resources that are being diverted and not in a very productive way. Again, as you pointed out, that money can't be used for infrastructure and other types of public goods. And so that is more of a corruption issue, you know, when corruption funds are being moved and laundered. But about all those criminals that are able to launder their funds and reinvest those funds in more criminal activity, or reinvest those funds into what we call sterile assets, like fur coats and diamonds, mm-hmm, and yachts, that don't generate much additional economic activity. In economics, we call it a multiplier effect. Those types of sterile investments don't have much of a multiplier effect. So there are losses there, too. The other thing that these criminal entities try to do after they launder their money is they invest some of those funds into legal businesses, or they set up legal businesses to help launder their funds, and those legal businesses don't necessarily need to be competitive. They can sell things very cheaply and underprice the legal competition and push legitimate companies that are owned by law-abiding citizens out of the market because of the laundering activity that they're doing that's keeping these other businesses running. I don't know that I'm being that clear, but this is exactly what happened in Colombia when narco-traffickers decided to invest in grocery store chains and pharmaceuticals. They pushed out a lot of legitimate grocery stores and drug stores. They put them out of business because they were able to not necessarily aim for a profit margin since they had all this laundering activity going mm-hmm. through those businesses.
Final word, Richard Gordon?
I agree completely. And if you sit out by the pool at a nice hotel in Panama City, in Panama, and you look out and you see these interesting skyscrapers up that are residential in theory, and as the sun goes down, no lights go on, which is kind of a puzzlement. You think that people who are living there might occasionally want to see what they're doing. But at least some of these buildings are mere laundromats, as Mayara was suggesting. So they are cash proceeds you get, or not even all cash proceeds. You pretend you have lots of tenants, and where's the money coming from? It's not coming from corruption. It's not coming from the drug trade. It's coming from my tenants. This is rents being paid to me. How do you prove that? Well, here I actually have a building. I built a building that nobody lives in. If that's not a dead loss, I don't know what is.
Fascinating. Well, thank you so much for being with us here in the Scholar Circle and for sharing your research and your wisdom with us and our listeners. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's been super fun.
Mayara Rusin is a professor at Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, California, and the director of the Financial Crime Management Specialization. She's the author of Terrorism Financing Methods, An Overview, and Dirty Laundering, Financing Latin America's Drug Trade. Richard Gordon is professor at Case Western Reserve University School of Law and director of the program on financial integrity. He's the author of Public Corruption and Money Laundering, Indicators for Terrorism Financing Through Financial Institutions, and A Model Regulation on the Prevention of Money Laundering and Financing of Terrorism. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.